You are listening to the Living Hope International Ministries Weekly Bible Teaching Podcast. For more information, visit us online at lhim.org.
Well, happy St. Patrick's Day to everyone. You don't have to be Irish to appreciate St. Patrick, but it does help. Anyhow, we are... We're going to begin in Luke chapter 16. My title for today is Parables of Generosity. And generosity is a big deal to Jesus. He talks about it a lot. I was thinking about statements of faith. You know, every church has a statement of faith, every ministry. I don't think I've ever seen a statement of faith where they put generosity as like one of the things they believe in. Isn't that something? And yeah, Jesus talks about it a lot. I'm accusing myself of that too, because I'm pretty sure I wrote our statement of faith, or at least revised it, and still we don't have it in there either. But maybe we should put it in there. You know, there's just so many things Jesus teaches us that we just sort of like, yeah, whatever. This is one of those things. So anyhow, I thought it would be good to focus on it today. Luke 16 has two parables in it, the parable of the dishonest manager, which is totally weird, and then the parable of the rich man of Lazarus, which makes the first one look normal. So it's going to be interesting, trust me. But before we get started, I want you to ask yourself a question. You don't answer out loud, but ask yourself the question, a little self-assessment here. I have three questions for you. One, in the past month, have you helped a stranger? Two, in the past month, have you donated to a charity? And three, in the past month, have you volunteered to an organization? I want to look at the data with you. I love data. I love facts. We're going to go to Luke 16, so if you have your Bible, you can go there now. But take a look at this. This is the, what is this? The Charities Aid Foundation. They ask these three questions that I just asked you to all these countries around the world every year. And this is the most recent data they have. It's from the year, it's the 2023 report, which is data from the year 2022. This year's report isn't out yet. And what they found is that in the USA, the USA is right here, that 80% of Americans say yes, I have helped a stranger in the last month. Isn't that incredible? I think we should be proud of that. That's an outlier. I mean, look at all the other top-ranking nations. Like, we're just really doing well there. We help strangers. That's something to be proud of. The second point was donating money to charity. 61% of Americans do that. It doesn't have to be a religious organization. It could be any organization, any kind of charity. And then the last one was volunteering. And boy, that's where we as a country have room to improve. 37% is pretty low. So as this report has it, by the way, in 2019, we were number one in the world, but we've fallen a little bit. Now we're number three in the year 2023. And you know, there's something interesting about this report, too. Like, if you look at the countries around the United States, they're not more affluent, right? The number one country in the world, and it has been for, I think, quite a few years since 2020 and on, is Indonesia. Indonesia has the highest rating for giving. And you know what the average annual salary in Indonesia is? It's about $10,000 a year. So, whereas in America, it's about $60,000 a year, average salary. So, America has literally six times as much money, and they're outgiving us. What is that? To me, that's fascinating. Or what about Kenya? Average salary in Kenya is about $1,800 a year. So, having more money doesn't mean you give more. I guess that's what I'm getting from the data. But then, you know, there are some other wealthy countries here too, like Australia, New Zealand. But then you have lots of other less wealthy countries in there. It is St. Patrick's Day, so we're just going to throw like the first European country. First place for all of Europe is Ireland. Must be doing something right. All right, back to Luke chapter 16. Luke chapter 16. Let's get into it. Let's see what Jesus says about it, because facts and figures, you know, they change every year. And the question is not really so much what does our country do? The question is, what should you do? And it says in Luke 16, verse 1, then Jesus said to his disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was squandering his property. That's not a good manager. Verse 2, so he summoned him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Give me an accounting of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer. So we're likely in this story, parables are not true stories. They're fictional stories. You know that, right? So this never actually happened. But in the story, there's this really rich guy, rich enough that he doesn't have to manage his own estate. He has somebody else doing that for him. I don't know about you, but I do not have a manager managing my estate. My wife and I have to do it ourselves. But this guy is so wealthy that he has a manager figuring things out for him. And so he's probably got a large farm, because that's the kind of world they lived in at the time of Christ. And this guy, somehow he got exposed for doing something bad. It's not really clear what happened. He squandered the money. He did something funny with his management. And he's getting fired. But before he gets fired, the owner is very smart. He wants to have a full audit of where everything's at before he fires this guy and puts a new person in the position. So the manager is sent to go, you know, basically give a report on the state of affairs. It says in verse 3, then the manager said to himself, what will I do now that my master is taking the position away from me? I am not strong enough to dig. I am ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do so that when I am dismissed as manager, people may welcome me into their homes. So he hatches a plan. This guy's really smart. He might have messed up, but he's not ready to just give up and say, all right, I'll just like become a beggar. I'll just go dig ditches. No. Let's figure out something else. Verse 5. So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he asked the first, how much do you owe my master? So the steward, the manager knows. He knows already how much everybody owes him. He's the manager. It's literally his job to know what they owe him. But he asks them anyhow. And I ask myself the question, why would he ask them how much they owe up front? It's the concept of anchoring. This is from the program on negotiation at Harvard Law School. This is a blog entry. Imagine that you are about to enter a job interview hoping for a salary of $75,000 based on your past experience and industry standards. If you are only offered a salary at $45,000, you may find yourself making a counteroffer of $55,000. Which is far less than you think you are worth. Due to the other party's first offer, the possibilities for an agreement have narrowed in your mind. The anchoring bias describes the common tendency to give too much weight to the first number put forth in a discussion and then inadequately adjust from that starting point or the anchor. So this is the idea of, it's a sales thing, the anchoring bias. Right, so you just start with a number that is just really, really low, or really, why are you smiling, Dina? Really, really high, and then everyone is just going to negotiate with reference to that number. So this guy, he says, well, how much, just remind me for a second, how much do you owe again? So he does that to these different people. Look at verse 6, and it says, he answered 100 jugs of olive oil. He said to him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 50. All right, when I read this, I saw 100 jugs of oil, okay, big whoop, you know, go to the store, buy some jugs of oil. Apparently oil was expensive in their world. It took a lot of processing to make oil from olives, I guess. So the number I got was that these jugs are actually very large. So 100 jugs was equivalent to 875 gallons of oil. Now imagine going to the store and buying 875. Now we're talking about a serious amount, which, based on the math that I used, added up to $90,000. Based on the price it was at their time, not based on, I think it would be much less for us today because we have, machines and stuff, factories, I don't know. But for them, it would be $90,000. So this guy's, he says, well, how much do you owe my master? It's like basically 90 grand. And he says, all right, make it 45. He just hooked this guy up with $45,000. Look at the next one, verse 7. Then he asked another, how much do you owe? He replied, 100 containers of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and make it 80. 100 containers of wheat is equal to 1,100 bushels, which is equivalent to $225,000. Again, this is not our price for wheat. This is their price in an ancient time. So $225,000, or 7.5 years of wages worth of wheat. And so he ends up taking 20% off, which, interestingly enough, also ends up being $45,000 in our money today. So these are huge amounts of money. You know, it's not just like, hey, I owe him 50 bucks. All right, pay him 40. No, we're talking about tens of thousands of dollars in today's money. And it says in verse 8, and his master commended the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. That should really confuse you. You just got ripped off. And the owner's gotten ripped off all this money, and he commends the dishonest manager. Does that make sense? Because he acted shrewdly. And then this is Jesus. For the children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than are the children of light. How is he shrewd? What he did was he ingratiated himself to wealthy people that owned his master money so that after he got fired, he'd have a place to go. He was clever, right? He was looking out for his own future. In order to do that, he had to basically... I'm trying to find an appropriate word to say this. Make his master lose a lot of money, okay? and that, I think most people would be like, I can't believe you did that. You really did me dirty. But instead, the master says, well, that was pretty clever what you did there. Right? And that's, and then Jesus is the one telling the story. He's like, this is the way the world is, and it's good, and you should learn from it. What? What is going on here? He got outmaneuvered in a business deal, and then he says, you got me. Nice job. Excuse me. Let's look at verse 8 again. His master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. And then again, this is Jesus. For the children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the children of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into eternal homes. How diligent, this is a question I want you to ask yourself, how diligent are you at using your wealth to make friends? We don't really think of it that way. In fact, I would say if you just tried to like buy a friend, you'd probably offend somebody more than like ingratiate them. But this is in fact what he's talking about then. Everything around us threatens of scarcity. You ever notice that? You never have enough? I've got all these bills, we have inflation. The car needs repairs, the home needs to be fixed, kids need braces, got to pay your college debt. You know, there's always all this financial pressure. You got to save for retirement. Can you really afford to give? Well, if you have a little, then you can give a little. Let's look at the next verse. Whoever is faithful in a very little is faithful also in much. And whoever is dishonest in a very little is dishonest also in much. If then you have not been faithful with dishonest wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful with what belongs to another, who will give you what is your own? No slave can serve two masters, for a slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. If you're faithful with the little, you will be faithful with much. Are you faithful with the little that you have? You know, one of the great insights of Jesus Christ with regard to money is to say that it's not, is a different way of thinking, is saying it's not yours, you're stewarding it. And that's just like a very simple idea, rather than saying it's mine, I earned it all with my own sweat and blood. You know, instead of having that greedy mindset or that entitled mindset that says, you know, there would be nothing if it weren't for me, saying instead, God has graciously given me the ability to make this money. Excuse me. And God has given me the ability to save this money. And so I'm stewarding it on God's behalf. And, you know, it doesn't mean you can't ever spend money on yourself and enjoy life. That's not what I'm saying. Okay, but what I am saying is that there's a tendency for money to own you. And I don't think that happens if you do things the way Jesus says. Because by giving to whoever it is you give, and it's not just really money either, because I think volunteering is extremely important as well, then it loosens its power around you. Let's look at verse 12 again. If you have not been faithful with what belongs to another, who will give you what is your own? You get it? Jesus is saying you should think of your money as not your own. You should think of it as something that belongs to another, and you're stewarding it, and then in the end, in the resurrection, then you get what is truly wealth. You can have wealth, but you should not serve wealth. Serve God with your wealth. All right, so there are a couple of examples I want to look at. And the first one is called The Rich Fool. It's another story Jesus told. And in this story, it goes like this. Then he told them a parable. This is Luke 12, 16. The land of a rich man produced abundantly, and he thought to himself, "What should I do? For I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns, build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich toward God." When I start reading this story that Jesus tells at another time, the parable of the rich fool, I think to myself, yes, that makes sense. Yes, that's prudent. You had a bumper crop. You don't have enough space to store it. You build new barns to hold more. That's all relevant and prudent and wise. I mean, who could fault this guy for doing this? I don't think that's the problem. The problem is when he says to himself, "Soul, we're good for now. We're good for the foreseeable future." And the problem that Jesus brings up here is that it's not so much that he has money, it's that he's not rich toward God. He only has money, and he doesn't have God. You've heard of minimum wage. Does anybody know what minimum wage is in New York State right now? $15, yeah. Let me ask you this. What's the maximum wage? Isn't that funny? We don't think of it like that. We don't think to ourselves, well, what's the maximum amount of money I could possibly use? And then, like, beyond that, I should just give everything away. That's not even a concept. But we do have a minimum where it's like anything less than this, and it's just like the end of the world, right? At what point do you seek to honor God with your money? You're never going to have enough money to start giving. There's never like a day where you say, okay, that's good. I have no more financial stress in my life. I'm going to just start giving now. There's literally never a day when that happens. Either you are giving or you're not giving. Whether you have a dollar and you give a penny, or you have $100 and you give $10 or whatever it is, you know, like there's just never a point. It's just something you have to cultivate in your life. So I know probably a lot of you are thinking, well, where should I give? Obviously, I think it's great to give to the church, but you know, there's a lot of places to give. We have a Congo Children's Fund you can give to. I've got a friend who's going to grad school right now, and he's raised $10,000, and he needs $17,000 more, or else he's not going to make it. You know, there's an example, and he's going there to study the New Testament. You could give to Jillian's fundraiser for cheerleading. This is one of my favorite. Because then you get Krispy Kreme donuts, which are a rare commodity, unavailable in this area. You can give to Mia's fundraiser. Right, Frank? Doesn't Mia have a fundraiser for flag football? Yeah, flag football. Mia's got a fundraiser. I mean, we're supposed to be giving people. You know, like, that's what we do as Christians. Give to Teen Challenge. Give to the food bank. Give to the Cancer Research Institute. You can give to Bethany Christian Services, which is just here in Latham. And what they do is they help people adopt children as an alternative to abortion. You can give to World Vision or Compassion International. The point is not so much where you give. It's that you are the kind of person that is generous. And not, again, just with your money, but also with... Really, the big issue is your heart. And we'll come back to that in a minute. Let's look at a positive example. I don't want you to feel guilty. Let's look at a positive example. Luke 19. This is not a parable. This is actually an incident in the life of Christ. There was a wee little man. A wee little man was he. Okay. No, I'm not going to sing that song. I sang once this year, or last year, whatever. It was enough. My dad hasn't even come back. No, I'm just kidding. But I said I'd like to sing a song now, and he's just like in the back. He's like, we Finnegans, we don't sing. You know, we don't sing. Anyhow, Luke chapter 19. He entered Jericho and was passing through it. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was short in stature. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree to see him because he was going to pass that way. When Jesus came to that place, he looked up and said, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried down and was happy to welcome him. All who saw it began to grumble and said, "He has gone to be the guest of one who is a sinner." Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "Look, half of my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much." Then Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and save the lost." Here's a guy who got his money in a questionable way. He's partnered with the Roman Empire to oppress his own people and collect taxes from them to give to the Roman Empire. But he meets Jesus and he says, "I'm giving away half." Can you imagine, just for a moment, if Elon Musk met Jesus, or Jeff Bezos met Jesus, or Bill Gates met Jesus, any one of these super rich people in our world, and said, I'm giving away half, they would literally fund all of the charities in the entire country. You know what I'm saying? Like, they have billions and billions. Like, they could just fund them all. That's what happens here with Jesus and Zacchaeus. He's uber wealthy. He's not just a tax collector. He's a chief tax collector. And he's saying, I've met Jesus. I'm giving away half. Isn't that incredible? Zacchaeus is an example of someone who's no longer owned by his money. Let's go back to Luke 16. All right, let's look at the response. So Jesus tells a story about the dishonest manager. And then he says to his disciples that they should... Did I miss that one part about... I think it was in verse 9. Let me hit verse 9 with you one more time. Okay, Luke 16, verse 9. It says, and I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into the eternal homes. Totally cryptic verse, right? What in the world is he talking about? So he says this, and then we get this bit with the Pharisees in verse 14. It says, the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all this, and they ridiculed him. So he said to them, you are those who justify yourselves in the sight of others, but God knows your hearts. For what is prized by humans is an abomination in the sight of God. So you have to understand the scene. So Jesus is telling these stories, and he's got his disciples there, but he's also got his critics, the Pharisees. And everybody's listening, and they're just like, that's an interesting story. And the Pharisees start making fun of Jesus. They're like, oh, this is ridiculous. Psst. You know, what do you mean, make friends of your money to to get welcome into eternal habitation? Like, what is that? And so Jesus says, you are those who justify yourself in the sight of others, but God knows your hearts. This really comes down to a heart issue. But here's the problem. Here's the problem. The problem is that I fear many of us Christians, we are more like the Pharisees than the disciples on this. We pat Jesus on the head and say, oh, those were simpler times when you lived, Jesus. Our world is way too... we have artificial intelligence. We have Neuralink. We're going to build a base on the moon as a launching pad to colonize Mars. Jesus, we have things in our world that you couldn't possibly I'm sure it worked in your time, but our time is too complicated. We've got stock markets. We've got short selling. We've got IRAs. We've got, what else we have? 401ks. We've got cryptocurrency. And here's my point. Here's my point. I say the teaching of Jesus is just as relevant now and even more so because it's so complicated. The more complicated our world is, the more complicated your life is, the more important simple solutions are. You don't need some complicated solution that takes an entire Excel spreadsheet to figure out. What you need is something simple, something to keep you grounded, something to keep you anchored, something that is going to work no matter what situation you're in. And having a generous heart is exactly such a thing. All the more we need to follow Jesus. When you're losing sleep, when you're working two or three jobs, when you're gambling or wasting your money, we need the words of Jesus. We need this example that he has of generosity. Whatever your situation is, you need Jesus' wisdom on this. We all do. Let's go down to verse 19. Let's jump into the second parable. The rich man and Lazarus. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen, who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who longed to satisfy his hunger with what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs would come and lick his sores. Whew. So one of the questions that people ask about this is it a parable or is it historical? And people sometimes get tripped up on the name Lazarus, because in the stories Jesus tells, he doesn't usually name people. So they think, oh, well, maybe this is a historical incident. But I believe it's a parable because for a few reasons, but it begins just like all the other parables. There was a rich man. You know, there was once a rich man in the land of, you know, it has that kind of parable sound, like a story sound to it. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple. It sounds just like the one in verse 1. There was a rich man who had a manager. And in the parables of Jesus, there's a lot of hyperbole. There are a lot of exaggerations. So, for example, in this parable, this rich man is not just like regular rich. He's wearing purple, which you have to understand the Roman Empire and what the rules were, but like you can't just wear whatever color you want, especially not purple, unless you had connections and unless you had approval to wear a royal color. And this guy doesn't banquet on Fridays. This guy banquets every day. And his house is so big he has a gate. I mean, this is an exaggerated wealthy person. And the poor guy isn't just poor, he's covered in sores, and he's just yearning, oh, if I could just have a crumb from the table. You know, like, it's just excessively, like, the most pathetic. Dogs are licking his sore, you know, like, as low as it gets, and the rich guy is just as rich as it can get. So it seems to me, like, exaggerate. That's how you make a point, is you exaggerate in these parables. And the other reason to think it's a parable is that it's at the end of a sequence of five parables. So there's in chapter 15, there's a parable of the lost sheep, then there's a parable of the lost coin, then there's a parable of the prodigal son, then there's a parable of the dishonest manager, and now we get the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. So it's the end of a sequence of five in a row. It makes sense that this would be a parable. But let's just take a moment. I want you to imagine yourself as the rich man here, okay? I know some of you have more, some of you have less, whatever. Just imagine yourself as the rich man here, and that your life is good. You are eating well, and you've got this Lazarus, whose name, by the way, means God has helped. So I think it's an ironic name. It's not just like a stock name. Lazarus is from the Hebrew Eleazar, and that translates to God has helped. So in verse 19, once again, you're the rich man. You ready? There was a rich man, or woman, who was dressed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who longed to satisfy his hunger with what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs would come and lick his sores. Now, most people in that society would say at the beginning of the story, this rich man is doing something right because God has blessed him. That's the assumption. And this poor man must have really sinned because his life is terrible. It's almost kind of like karma, how they thought about this. And Jesus comes against this over and over and over throughout his ministry. The rich man knows about this Lazarus. This Lazarus is at his gate, lying there. What would you think to yourself if you were super wealthy in this world at the time of Christ and you had this poor beggar at your gate? What would you think to yourself? You probably would ask yourself the question, should I give to him? And what would your heart say? No, he's lazy. If he worked, then he would earn a living. Or maybe you would say to yourself, no, he'll just spend it on liquor. You know they had liquor in the time of Christ, right? Liquor's been around. Oh, no. If I give to him, he'll never go away. Then he'll become a dependent on me. Or no, I shouldn't give to him because if I give to him, then he'll tell all his poor friends, and then I'll have like a poor tent city at the gate, and I'll have to support all these poor people. Right? It doesn't say what he was thinking, but whatever it was just like, No, I don't think I want to do that. I don't think that would be good. Day after day, the rich man has to literally, every day you go out, you have to go through and see this guy. And just imagine that over time, he might have started to ask himself the question, maybe I should, and then eventually didn't even see the guy anymore. Just had hardened his heart, doesn't even see the suffering. He just walks by. His heart is not pierced by a man who is lying on the ground, who's covered in sores, who's being licked by wild animals. And he doesn't see it. Unbelievable. Well, then everybody dies. Verse 22. The poor man died and was carried away by the angels to be with Abraham. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, where he was being tormented, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So in the story, again, this is a fictional story, they die and they switch places in the afterlife. Now in the afterlife, it says Lazarus is at Abraham's bosom. Abraham is the patriarch, is the founder, is like the grandfather of the original Israel. Highest place of honor will be to sit with Abraham. And meanwhile, this rich man is, it says, tormented. Now, normally in the Bible, dead people are said to be asleep. Okay, which is obviously a metaphor. We know that dead people aren't like actually sleeping. But the metaphor means you're not awake. It means you're unconscious. The metaphor cannot mean you're awake, because to be awake is the opposite of being asleep. Okay, so in the Bible it says that you are asleep. In fact, when Jesus was dealing with the historical Lazarus, like the real Lazarus, he died. This is a story about Lazarus, but there was a real Lazarus, and the real Lazarus in John chapter 11 died, and Jesus says, he has fallen asleep, and I go to wake him. And it says he was speaking of his death. And it doesn't say his body has fallen asleep. It says, no, Lazarus has fallen asleep. John 11:11, you check it out. Lazarus has fallen asleep, I go to wake him. So normally in the Bible, dead people are asleep. But there is an exception. There are a couple of exceptions. One would be Isaiah chapter 14. In Isaiah chapter 14, we get this rich, poetic taunt against the king of Babylon. It says in Isaiah 14, 9 through 11, Sheol beneath is stirred up to meet you when you come. It rouses the shades to greet you, all who were leaders of the earth. This is a way of talking about dead people. It calls them shades. I don't know if you caught that. So the idea is the king of Babylon, this great guy, conquers so much space, you know, the whole Babylonian empire. He dies, and all the dead people wake up. They rouse, and they're like, oh, look at you. Come to join us in the realm of the dead. That's what Hades or Sheol is. It's the realm of the dead. It's poetic, right? You can do things in poetry that you can't do with regular prose. It says, look at verse 10. All of them will speak and say to you, you too have become as weak as we. You have become like us. Your pomp is brought down to Sheol, and the sound of your harps. Maggots are the bed beneath you, and worms are your covering. All right. No one would think this is literal. It's a poetic scene. And so this story Jesus tells about the rich man and Lazarus is likewise, I wouldn't say poetic, but it's a folk tale. How do I know it's a folktale? All right. There was once a priest and a taxi driver. Do you already know that this is going to be a not true story? Like just with that start? Or what if I said, you know, a rabbi, a priest, and a Protestant minister went in a bar? Like you already know it's not historical. How many words does it take before you figure out that something is like a folktale and not historical? Let me tell my story. There was once a priest and a taxi driver, and the taxi driver drove wildly, crashed. They both died. They stood before St. Peter at the pearly gates, and the priest goes to enter in first. St. Peter, this is a good St. Patrick's Day joke, right? St. Peter says, hold it there. Let the taxi driver in first. So the taxi driver goes into the celestial city first. And the priest is upset. This guy was celibate for life. He's letting the taxi driver in. The priest says to St. Pete, he says, why are you letting the taxi driver? I spent my whole life serving God. And St. Peter says, well, in your homilies at church, everybody slept. But when this taxi driver drove, everybody prayed. All right, now let's imagine it's 1,000 years from now, and I write that in a book, okay? And I don't say just kidding afterwards. Let's just say I tell that story in a book. It's 1,000 years from now. People are looking back on it. They find it in the archives in this ancient American 21st century English dialect that we all speak and we think is so modern, right? And they look at it and they're like, oh, look at that. Pastor Sean must have really believed in St. Peter and the value of taxi drivers. It's a folk tale. It's a story. You know, it's like that. So it is with Jesus and the rich man of Lazarus. And the reason why we know this, once again, is because we have it in other versions. We have the same story from Egypt. We have a version of it from Egypt where it's the kingdom of the dead, and you have a funeral, and the rich man is given all these honors, and all these people show up, and then there's a poor man who's just buried, and then in the kingdom of the dead, their fates are switched. We have that story. And then there are 7 versions of this from the Jewish people, of the same story that Jesus tells. So what I'm telling you is that people in their world, when they heard there was a rich man, you know, they don't know where he's going yet, but when they die and they get switched, they're like, oh, this is Bar Mayan. You know, that's the story of the rich tax collector and the poor student of the Bible and how they switch. You know, they get it. But then Jesus does something interesting. Well, let's just keep going. I got to speed up here or else I'm going to run out of time. Verse 24, he called out, Father Abraham. So this is the rich man. He's in torment. It says, he called out, Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in agony in these flames. But Abraham said, child, remember that during your lifetime you received your good things and Lazarus in like manner evil things, but now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. So that's the reversal. Besides all this, between you and us is a great chasm that has been fixed so that those who might want to pass from here to you cannot do so, and no one can cross from there to us. So this also shows us that the story can't be real because they've got fingers and tongues and, you know, body parts that they shouldn't have if they're dead. But whatever, it's a story. And in this story, it's like, oh, can you just send him over to just dip his finger and just like give me a drop of water? And Father Abraham's like, no, bro, you're just going to have to chill over there in the torment section. He's going to be over here in the enjoy section. And that's where the folktale ends. Jesus adds verse 27 and on. This is fresh. It says, he said, then I beg you, Father, to send him to my father's house. Verse 28, for I have 5 brothers, that he may warn them, so that they will not also come into this place of torment. Abraham replied, they have Moses and the prophets. They should listen to them. He said, no, Father Abraham, but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent. He said to him, if they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead. That's all fresh. That's all Jesus. That's all original. That little ending part. And what is he saying here? He's speaking to the Pharisees and he's saying to them, look, you have everything you need to do right by the poor man. You have everything you need. You have the poor man. You have money. You have Moses. You read Deuteronomy, it talks about the poor a lot. You read the book of Proverbs, it says the one who lends to the poor lends to God. I mean, we have what we need to do this. Now, here's a question I want to ask you, just kind of winding down here. Do you notice how these two parables connect? The parable of the dishonest manager and the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. They're not independent parables. They're meant to connect and explain each other. The parable of the dishonest manager ended with the statement, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into eternal homes. The second parable is an illustration of the first parable. Specifically, it illustrates the case where a rich man did not make friends using his dishonest wealth and then did not get welcomed into eternal homes. Daryl Bach says, it is important to recognize that the parable of the rich man and Lazarus illustrates Jesus' teaching in 16:9 about using wealth generously. The rich man is not condemned because he is rich, but because he slipped into the coma of callousness. Listen to me. Do not allow your heart to grow hard when it comes to generosity. You do not want to be stuck in the coma of callousness and have your wake-up call on Judgment Day. He slipped into the coma of callousness that wealth often produces. He became consumed with his own joy, leisure, and celebration and failed to respond to the suffering and need of others around him. I'd like to conclude with a story. When I was attending the Atlanta Bible College, they had a campus in a town called Morrow, Georgia. It's like tomorrow without the two. A very rundown place when I was attending there. And crime has started to rise to such a degree that we had a gas station about a quarter mile down the road from the campus. It would get robbed every week. Like, there would be cops coming, and it was like, oh, the gas station got robbed again. And, you know, there were projects on either side of the Bible College, and people would come over, and my wife had her digital camera stolen right out of the car. It was getting to be really, really a rough area. And so the denomination, the Church of God, decided to sell the Atlanta Bible College, to sell the campus. And so that's what they did. They sold the campus to a neighboring college, which was happy to buy it. And they went and they rented space in a beautiful, very, very new four-story building in a different town that didn't have the crime problems. Well, over time, they ran into some financial trouble. And this is a picture of Joe Martin, who prefers to be called Dr. Joe, which I'm happy to do. So Dr. Joe took over the leadership position, and I think that could be Dan Wall on the front. Is that you in the front of the Braves hat on? No? Okay. Well, somebody looks, it's his stunt double. So Dr. Joe took over the president of the Bible College, and the money was gone. The money from the sale of the campus was gone. And the whole idea was they were going to buy a new campus, but they had gotten stuck in this renting situation, and the rent was so high that the college was $200,000 in deficit for the year, and they didn't have the money to buy a campus, and they were just in dire straits. So you know what Dr. Joe did? He started praying. He started praying, and the staff had a weekly prayer meeting, and he told the staff, I want you to come with me outside, and we're going to walk around this building. He literally made the staff, this is so funny because I know these people, he made them go downstairs and walk around the building and pray. He did it once every week for 7 weeks, or for 6 weeks. And then on the seventh week, you know what he did? Had him walk around it 7 times in that day, just like Joshua around the city of Jericho. Shortly after that, he got an email that a pastor had died and had left behind $1 million. Now, the building was worth $5 million, but 2008 and the financial crash and all this happened, it was in foreclosure, and they were able to get the building for like $1 million or $1.2 million cash. Because and the thing about this pastor from Ohio is nobody even knew he had money. He drove an old Buick. He lived in just a regular house. He literally had $1 million sitting in the bank. You know, and that's how God can use generosity in these surprising ways. So now they own the whole building, and they can rent it out to other people at exorbitant rates to fund them. It's an incredible story of generosity. So in conclusion, be generous. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we ask and just pray that you would help us to have hearts of generosity. I know we're all in different places financially, and you know, some of us are in college, some of us are in high school, some of us are wishing that we were still in college or in high school, but we're not. Father, I just ask that you would give us a heart to see the poor man, to see the need in our lives, to see the cause that can really help, whatever it happens to be. We pray that you would give us a desire and that you would bless how we all give. And I just also want to thank you for the contributions that are made, because they are generous, and we just are so thankful for how you take care of us. And we pray this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thanks for listening. Visit us at lhim.org, where you can access dozens of free classes, Bible teachings, and articles. Also, when you visit lhim.org, subscribe to receive email updates so you won't miss out on upcoming events. Until next week, keep loving God and your neighbor.